This is an ABC podcast.
Today it's part two of a special series this week called Armistice. And it begins in the Picardy region of northern France in a little village called Naur. Just on the edge of this village is a network of caves that were carved out of the chalky hillside by hand hundreds of years ago. People started digging these caves way back in the Middle Ages, and eventually they grew into a virtual underground city, a huge survivalist shelter that was built for the entire population of the village.
Your tech has been before or not?
Gilles Prilot is a local archaeologist who works in these caves.
Bonjour, Gilles.
Bonjour.
We caught up with Gilles in the cafe just outside the caves of Naur, having his morning coffee with the groundskeepers.
Gilles, how big is this network of caves here at Naur?
Long tunnels, approximately 1 kilometer, the tunnels, and 200 or 300 rooms in these caves.
200 to 300 rooms?
Yeah.
The first thing I wanted to know was why? What crisis could be so bad that would make an entire village want to claw out a survival shelter from a hillside?
This is the beginning of my story. In 2013, I started archaeological investigation to dating the origin of these caves. And I found coins, musket bullets, piece of pottery that prove men occupied these caves early in the 17th century during the 30 Years' War.
The 30 Years' War. This was every bit as ugly as it sounds. The 30 Years' War broke out in the 17th century, and it began as one of those European wars of religion between Catholics and Protestants, fighting each other with muskets and swords and pistols and pikes and cannons. But after a while, the whole conflict just degenerated into mindless chaos. Large parts of Europe became lawless war zones, with bands of soldiers roaming the countryside, helping themselves to whatever they wanted from local farms and villages.
Yeah, the farmers have the idea to digging caves to protect them, of course, and cereals, animals, the treasure of farmer of Picardy.
So when the people of Naur got word that these bandits were in the area, they would simply hole up inside these caves until the danger had passed. The villagers got very clever at hiding from these roaming bandits. They concealed their presence in the caves by routing the chimneys from their baker's ovens up into the above-ground cottages, so no one would suspect they were there. Anyway, the war ended, and things began to settle down, and after a while, the caves were abandoned, the entrances were sealed up.
And the caves of Naur was forgotten.
And they lay silent and dark for hundreds of years.
And one day, the priest of the village, his name is L'Abbé Danicourt, discovered on a book Naur, very famous about his quarries.
Quarries and the caves.
Quarries. Yeah. And all the village helped him to discover this site. 2 weeks after, L'Abbé Danicourt discovered a first entrance on 1887.
The priest was amazed to find a huge network of hundreds of rooms and tunnels. In the underground city, they found abandoned wells, bakeries, and chapels, and a stable for the horses. So this is what brought Gilles Prilot to Naur in 2013, searching through the caves to find artifacts from the 30 Years' War. And then one day, Gilles found something he wasn't looking for at all. Gilles led me down into the underground city of Naur to show me the room where he made this discovery.
Be careful your head for 3 meters, okay?
3 meters, okay. It's a very small space. It's barely high enough for me to stand up in. And in the corner, there's a couple of bats, little tiny bats.
I came in this room on 2013, on the dark, and I have just a spotlight. And what I saw, it's amazing.
Gilles' spotlight revealed little scribblings that were all over the cave wall, written in thick lead pencil.
And I say, whoa, what's that?
And when he looked up close, he saw that they were all names.
I saw one name, two names, so many names.
Thousands of names of soldiers, Australian soldiers mostly, from the First World War, who came here 100 years ago.
In all the world, you have traces, signature, made with wood pencil, okay?
A wooden pencil,
fragile, okay?
And next to the name, they'd written where they were from.
9th Battalion, Australians, yeah. Fitzhenry.
Fitzhenry, Paddington, Sydney,
New South Wales.
Okay.
Alistair Ross.
July 1916, Alistair Ross, Lismore. It's very surprising in first, okay?
F.W. Robert, R.F. Morkill, F.J. Norris, L. Stimson.
And then, when he checked the other rooms, he saw that Australians had written their names all over the walls of those rooms as well. There were thousands of these names of Australian soldiers who had come here to the underground city of Nauru for some reason and felt compelled to record their existence in this really fragile way.
N. Dougal, New South Wales.
And the names of these men are still there.
1916.
100 years later.
H.F.C. Baker, South Australia, July 13, 1916.
Gilles noticed that so many of the names were followed by abbreviations for Australian military units that he since learned how to decode.
Here, you are a soldier steward with your model number. First, Anzac. With the Compagnie of Egypt and Compagnie de France.
PJW Stewart, 3906, Anzac, Egypt, France, 1916.
Yeah.
And this is just one of thousands. I'm just looking around and there's thousands of names here. There's thousands of names here, all over these cave walls, written in tiny letters, mostly in pencil, a few in pen, on these walls.
For Gilles, the presence of these thousands of Australian names in the caves was a mystery. So he went about tracking down some of the descendants of these men.
This tracing is important for me because it's the first I study. A.C. Wade, it's easy. Wade is a name. A.C., the two letters of the first name. B. Coy, B. Company, Company B, okay? 9th Battalion, July 1916. And with that, I can find on the archive of Australia all the records of this man. I find his photography. It's the first inscription I understand.
Gilles, have you been in touch with some of the families, the descendants of the men who wrote their names on these walls?
Yeah. When I contact the descendant, I understand the importance of his treasure for the Australian people. One day, in this room, I do a visit for teenager Australian musician. There are 8 or 10, I don't remember. And I show the wall, I show the signature, and in one moment, I see 3 or 4 crying. And I have a son, I have teenager son. I know the priority for my son, computer, telephone. I can't imagine my son crying for traces of soldier. And this day, I understand the importance to communicate this information to the Australian people, all this treasure.
So he connected some of the names on the walls with the names in the Australian military records. In Australia, we have these unusually comprehensive records of the men who came to France and to Belgium to fight in World War I.
Look, it's very interesting because I don't know why, but Australians gave a lot of information in
a little part, okay?
Look. Lots of information in a tiny space.
Yeah.
And because the archive of Australian is very, very complete, we can find his military history, yes, but his story as a letter of his family, photography, is very complete.
Just looking on this wall here, at the very top, written very faintly in pencil, is Captain I. Margaret, Tasmania.
How? Ivor Sir Margaret, the real hero, great personality. He was a football player, okay, in Tasmania. All these soldiers of him have a big, big respect for him. And he got to the Somme, Battle of the Somme.
We tracked down a living relative of Captain Ivor Margaret, named Barry Margaret. Barry lives in Melbourne.
I'm a nephew. I'm the son of his brother Vernon.
I spoke with Barry in ABC Studios.
I read about or heard about the Cave of Naiores, but I had no idea. I wondered whether Ivor had been there, but I didn't know his name was there. I was, you know, surprised, but not surprised, I suppose.
Barry is now in his 80s, but he remembers as a little boy looking up at a picture of his uncle Ivor that hung on the wall.
A picture of Ivor, a large photograph of Ivor with a rather sort of wry smile on his face, looking at the photographer. My father had a sort of change room come office in the home, and this was a prominent feature all my growing up years. In fact, I've still got the picture at home, and it's just a classic photo of a young guy.
He was a very sharply dressed, good-looking young man, wasn't he?
I think both Ivor and his father, Stephen, stood out in the crowd. They were just the sort of guys that could probably throw their clothes on the floor in the night and put them on in the morning and still look well-dressed.
The Margaret's family had a great reputation in Tasmania.
This family was a very active family, community active, civil-minded.
Heavily involved in the local church and in local sport, and Ivor in particular was very highly regarded.
After the Second War, I was over in Tasmania and also I was working in the city in Melbourne. People who had known Ivor always spoke highly of him.
Ivor Margaret's had been a schoolteacher in Hobart. He was a big, tall man, 6'4", with a clever turn of phrase. Ivor was 23 years old when he signed up for the First World War, and he was on one of the first boats to splash ashore at Gallipoli. Ivor was very popular with his men for his good humour and his good judgment. At Gallipoli, his uniform was shot to pieces, but somehow none of the bullets actually entered his body. Ivor might have thought he was unkillable for a while after that, but ultimately he was a realist about war. He was an officer, so it often fell to him to write to the families of killed and missing soldiers. He wrote about this duty in a letter to his family. He said, "I have been rather busy writing to broken-hearted mothers, giving them details regards killed and missing men. One has frequently to cut out some of the details. People ask if you can tell them the last words and who was holding their hands when they snuffed out. I could not very well say. The poor chap was cursing fairly well and was being held down on the stretcher by three or four dirty stretcher bearers who also put in an occasional curse." After he was evacuated from Gallipoli, Ivor Margaret was sent to France, and he and his men were deployed to the Somme, ahead of the bloody Battle of Pozières. The Somme offensive had begun in early 1916 as an attempt to push back the Germans and smash a hole in their defences. But by mid-July, the British commander, Douglas Haig, had given up on that. The point now, to his mind, was to engage the enemy in what he called a wearing-down war. Paul Hamm is an Australian historian who lives in France, and he's the author of several books on the First World War, including 1914 and Passchendaele. And on a windy afternoon in the Somme Valley, Paul told me about the thinking behind this wearing-down war strategy.
Haig had a secondary motive for fighting this battle, as he did with all of the battles, in fact, on the Western Front. That was his case for wearing down the German army. In other words, a pure war of attrition. This implied massive casualties. When you read about, when you hear about, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions dead and wounded on the Western Front, that was planned. These statistics weren't some sort of colossal epic error of judgment. They were planned. Haig and his commanders knew that if they were fighting a war along a trench line, an unbreakable trench lines, with the kind of artillery that they were deploying at that time, you were going to have massive casualties. To send waves and waves of young men into those lines, into that battlefield, you're going to have a huge number killed and wounded. They called it normal wastage.
Captain Ivor Margetts survived the whole of the Gallipoli campaign, but on the first day of the Battle of Pozieres, he was hit by a fragment from a bursting shell. Afterwards, the family received a letter from one of his men, a Private Mackenzie, who was with him when he died. Mackenzie wrote, "It was about between 9 o'clock and 9:15 when Captain Margetts was sitting in a shell hole, giving orders to a sergeant by the name of Clark, and one shell burst right in among us. Well, it took me half a minute to get over the shock of it, and I heard your son calling me. I crawled to him, and he said, 'I have got one at last.' I got him into the trench and ripped his shirt and singlet with my scissors and found a wound over his heart the size of a penny. I dressed him and gave him a drink, but it was all over. He lived for about 20 minutes. I stayed with him to the end, and these were the words he said before he went. He said, 'Is that you, Mackenzie?' I said, 'Yes, sir.' He said, 'If you get through this stink, lad, which I hope you do, let my people know how I got hit and died thinking of them.' He caught my hand and passed away. I left him till the morning and got him buried and put a cross over his grave. I was all through the Gallipoli muck with your son, so I ought to know him well. There was never a better officer living than Captain Margetts. He was the most popular man in the battalion, and he never done a bad turn to anyone since we left Hobart Shore. It is the worst shock the 12th Battalion has had since the war started. Anyone would have gave their life for to save his little toe."
His men loved Margetts, and they made on the battlefield his burials with this white cross. You know this cross? Because they have a picture, extraordinary a picture.
The picture Gilles showed me of Ivor Margetts' grave on the battlefield of Pozieres has become one of the most famous images of the whole war. It's a strange and mournful picture. It looks like the surface of the moon. It's a field of muddy lumps of earth, and in the middle is a small, pristine, white cross that seems to glow with its own light, but it's just reflecting the late afternoon sun. Margetts' grave stood in place for 2 days, but then it was obliterated.
A few days after, German shells destroyed this place, and his burial place disappeared. Nobody knows where Margetts is today.
Can you tell me how the family reacted, Barry, when they found out that Ivor had died at Pozieres?
I just think there was a sense of loss that went right through the family and never went away with the brothers.
A lot of people talk about how talented Ivor was, how clever he was, what a natural leader he was. What do you think Australia lost in a man like Ivor?
I think Australia lost an enormous part of its future. People have said that he was the sort of guy who could have been anything. He was charismatic, he was a keen sportsman and a leader. On the beaches of Anzac, he organised football matches, keep up the morale of the troops. He was obviously a guy who was restless to sort of keep things moving. A guy like Ivor could have been anything, and I'm sure there were plenty of similar family losses around the country of wonderful young guys.
The death of Ivor put an end to any plans that Barry's dad might have had to join his older brothers in France.
Dad was supposed to be joining up late in 1916. By that stage, Ivor had been killed and Ralph had been gassed, and he managed to break his arm the day before by cranking a car. So by the time he reported, the recruiting officer said to my grandfather, "Mr. Margaret, take the boy home, take the lad home. Your family's given enough."
Your dad had received a letter from Ivor. What can you tell me about that letter, Barry?
I've got a few letters, not many, but they reveal a warm relationship between an older brother and a younger brother, and a sort of a teasing, jocular sort of person, and someone who was very much wanting to serve king and country and encouraging his younger brother along those sort of paths.
When you look at that photo of that sort of thin, almost gleaming white cross over Ivor's grave on that kind of cratered moonscape of the Pozières battlefield, what does that make you think and feel when you look at that picture, Barry?
It's a strange business, but it pulls together my grandfather's entry in the family register, home first, and it pulls together, I guess, my father's reticence, and it pulls together the horrors of what young men, and these were only boys, went through, and the wastefulness of it all. The Great War overshadowed everything. It was not uncommon to see people who'd lost a limb and had peg legs, people with all sorts of disabilities. We had a caretaker come gardener on a property we had at Beaconsfield. He used to show me where he had these little bits of shrapnel under his skin and so on, and also he had a drinking problem, and I think that was common. And what we now call post-traumatic stress disorder, I think, was probably reasonably common.
Have you been over to France to see the battlefields that Ivor and the others fought in?
Yes, I was fortunate. We went over to visit, and we did go down to Pozières, and we visited the windmill site where Ivor was killed. I had my son and his German wife and my grandson, who carries both citizenships, and we were all sort of fairly affected by it. And they were only boys and fell and no one knew where.
Having a German grandson with you there must have been a quite a powerful thing as well. I mean, that's the product of love, not war.
Yes, and we've got a photo of myself with my grey hair and my son and his little blonde-haired boy looking out over where Ivor was killed, and you think, goodness, this is so odd. It's just funny in a strange way. And when my son was getting married in Germany, they were married in a church up above Dortmund, and there's a little knoll where there was an old castle, and we went for a little walk, and looking out over the valley and down on Dortmund, I somehow got quite a surprise to find a memorial to the local soldiers, and there was a German soldier lying there, statue, and you realise all the memorials we've got around our country, other countries have them, and maybe the enemy's got them too, but it just seems all so crazy.
You mean the fight and the war, you mean?
The fight and the war and so on. There's huge losses on both sides.
While Barry and his family were in France, they went just down the road from Pozières to the little town of Albert to visit the cathedral. And that's where Barry had a surprising encounter with one of his uncles.
In the catacombs under the cathedral, they've recreated the trenches, and they've got all the bits and pieces that go with it. And we rounded the corner, and there was a photo that was familiar to me, because I had the same one at home, of my Uncle Athel standing by the grave with the cross with the wreath around it, which was not the original cross, but a cross that was erected later. The original cross was lost, but they had the coordinates, and someone had replaced the cross with one with a laurel wreath on it. And there in the catacombs was this picture of my Uncle Athel and the cross over Ivor's grave, and it brings home the warmth that's felt in Pozieres towards the Aussies, and that continues to this day. There's an active warmth in the Somme area for the Aussies and what they did for the French people.
This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
We have 2,000 signatures, okay.
And there's one name that appears three times here. Lieutenant A.S. McPherson, 15th Battery.
Yes, he wants everybody remember he passed here, I think. But his officer, Alan Stuart McPherson, and when I observed a picture of him, I saw Errol Flynn. And I love Errol Flynn, and I think he resembles Errol Flynn.
Did I upset your plans? You've come to Nottingham once too often. When this is over, my friend, there'll be no need for me to come again.
Alan Stuart McPherson's my grandfather.
Gilles tracked down a descendant of Alan Stuart McPherson in Australia.
I can sort of see the resemblance. He's like a sort of 1930s movie star.
I spoke with Angus McPherson in the ABC in Brisbane.
What I've got to remember, my grandfather are letters, and I've got the medals, but the thought that there's something almost far more real, that he signed his name in a cave before going to battle is extraordinary.
What kind of a life did he have growing up in Australia?
He was from Charters Towers, and to the south of Charters Towers on the Cape River, there's a station called Egira Station, which actually still exists today. So they had probably 2,000 cattle there, and he was the overseer. And there's a picture I've got of a rainwater tank which was made in Charters Towers, which had to cross 14 rivers to get to the station with a bullock train. And a Model T Ford on the back as well. So, I mean, transporting that and then transporting artillery guns through the mud, I suppose, might have had similarities, I'm not sure. So I would have thought that kind of toughness would have set him up rather well for what was ahead there to some degree, but I guess how could anyone be adequately prepared for that, I'm not sure.
Looking at his battle history, it's extraordinary. I mean, it's completely extraordinary.
Yeah.
He was in the Somme Offensive. He was at Passchendaele.
Yes. Well, he started off at Armentières, then he went south to the Somme, 3 months there, I think, and then north to Ypres, back to the Somme, and just after that, Bullecourt and Vichy Ridge. So he couldn't have been to worse places.
I don't know if you're going to have the answer to this question, but how did he survive? I mean, how did he survive going to all those places?
Well, to put it in perspective, on the ship that he left on November 1915, there were 9 officers, and he was the only officer to return. So I can't answer the question. I guess there has to be a lot of luck. But when you read about the actions that he was involved in to get his military cross and also the bar to the military cross, he sort of went out of his way to make it even riskier.
Yeah. Well, now tell me about the event that actually earned him the military cross.
Yeah, well, the military cross was in the 22nd of April 1917, and there was an enemy shell that landed in the ammunition depot. So he jumped into the pit, and with his hands he pulled out the burning cartridges and put earth on them and succeeded in extinguishing them, and so the armory didn't blow up. And then he went to bed that night, and you think he would have had an easy day the next day, but on the 23rd of April, the next day, they were being heavily shelled by the Germans, and two men had had their legs blown off, so he went into the area where they were, no man's land I guess it was, under fire, and brought each of the men back and provided them with tourniquets and saved their lives. So
are you saying he did these two separate acts of extraordinary bravery in 2 days?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, it's quite staggering. When I first read it, I couldn't imagine. So it said a lot for him that he could do that the next day. I mean, it's extraordinary, really.
He was injured at one point. What was the nature of his injury?
He received a splinter from a shell in his hip, and he recovered in England at a hospital, and then returned to battle in 1918, I think, in March. And he always walked with a limp on that leg.
Tell me about the woman he met while he was recovering in England.
Well, he met a daughter of a Lord Seymour, whose husband had actually died 18 months earlier, so she had actually had four children. But they required a rather large dowry. So he wrote a letter to his uncle, a very, very successful and rich pastoralist, James Sinsman Love, and he was totally uncooperative and sort of dismissive of it because he didn't feel that the daughter of a lord would go that well in the back blocks of Charters Towers.
Would have done her the world of good.
It would have, mate. It would have been the making of her, that's for sure.
They'd be making movies about her now with Nicole Kidman in the role. That's what they'd be doing.
Yeah, well, he didn't get married, and I'm not living in a castle in England, but anyway, that's like the crossroads.
So what kind of a life did he have once he returned home to Australia?
Well, he returned to the station at Egera, and he stayed on there for 10 or 12 years, but his uncle wasn't very generous to the two brothers, so they then moved to the Hunter Valley, to a place called Lindisfarne.
Did he ever talk to your father about the war, about the actual fighting?
Yeah, he only talked on two occasions. His one description of incoming artillery fire into the trenches was sort of rather horrific. He described it as a wave of body parts coming back upon them. When I first heard it, I think I was only, 9 years old, and at that stage war was a fun game to play with your friends, but that really hit home what it was all about. He sort of didn't have a concept of people who weren't brave. That was the other thing he talked to my father about. So they were probably the only two occasions that he ever talked to my father about the war.
What got you interested in the family history, to investigate his war history?
I knew of his military cross, and I also knew that his brother went to war as well and received a military cross as well. So, both brothers returned, which is rather unusual. So I wanted to understand what he may have been through and what he did, and how just sort of grateful we should be, and certainly I am, for what he did in going.
Knowing what your grandfather did, is he more knowable to you, or is he fundamentally unknowable as the man who could go there, survive that, do those brave things, and come back and still nonetheless go on and have a good life afterwards?
Yeah, I think I don't know whether I'll ever get my head around how I could do those things in 2 days. And then also on the 18th of September 1918, basically do exactly the same thing as the second action. Rescue one of his sergeants who was seriously wounded and under fire, so he did it again. I wish that he'd live longer. I have some very vague memories. He died when he was 67 and I was only 4 years old, so I remember him having great presence, and he was a great gentleman. My two grandfathers, if they stood at a door, I was told no one would go through because they'd both be they were all old school gentlemen, is what I'm trying to say. Yeah.
first breakthrough signature that Gilles was able to decode belonged to an Australian soldier named Stuart Cecil Wade. Gilles showed me his picture.
It's the first inscription I understand in now.
Stuart Cecil Wade, Company B, 9th Battalion. You found the man who wrote this.
Yes, it's a simple soldier, but he was wounded 3 times and he returned to Australia. Okay.
He came back alive.
Yeah.
Wounded 3 times and still he came home alive. Lynn Hayes is a living relative of Stuart Cecil Wade.
I'm his niece. He was the 3rd son. My father was the 4th son. There was 2 sisters in between, and there was another brother after my father. I knew nothing about the war because he never spoke of it, and nobody else much did, and nothing was ever talked about.
Where was the family based before World War One broke out?
In the Kyogle area. They had property all around out there. The eldest 3 boys, who all went to World War One, came with their father with all their lock, stock and barrel and the cattle. And the 1st son, Stan, was killed at Gallipoli. And then his 2nd brother, Alan, was killed in the last big battle at Villers.
Villers-Bretonneux?
Yes.
So what do you know about your uncle, Stuart Cecil Wade?
Only what has been handed to me by other members of the family. He was wounded 3 times in the war. The 1st time was in the arm. They sent him to London. The 2nd time was in the side, and they sent him back. And then the 3rd time was in the head.
So they were really just patching him up and then sending him back in.
Yes, that's how it happened.
So what were his years back in Australia like once he got back?
Well, my grandparents, they had a property. So when he came back from the war, he took over the property out at Ettrick and stayed there. And then his 2 other brothers, my father and Harvey, had auctioneering business at Benalbo, and he went and worked with them for a while. And then I think he sort of was... they made jobs for him.
Had his wounds healed by the time he got back?
No, they hadn't, because his wife said that she had to bathe them and dress them. He wasn't a well man. And the wound in his head was turning him blind at the very end. That was his head wound, and it was the wound in his side that actually killed him. 3rd of December 1934, age 40 years.
Your father was too young to go and fight when war broke out. Did he cop much flak for that, Lynn?
He did. I've been told he got a white feather.
Now, this was a not uncommon practice in Australia in the First World War. Men who were seen walking around the streets in civilian clothes would sometimes be approached by a woman who would walk up to them and put a white feather in their jacket pockets to shame them as cowards for not volunteering to fight.
He was too young, and they wouldn't sign his papers, and why would you after 3 sons had been killed? Yes, he did cop a lot of flak.
Now, you mentioned that 2 of his brothers had also died during the war.
Yes.
How did losing 3 brothers affect the family?
It did affect them very much. His mother passed away from breast cancer. And then on the July the 3rd, 1922, the boy's father, John, wrote to the army in a very shaky handwriting requesting Alan's victory medal, including a cheque for £10.10 to cover the cost of headstones for the 2 boys. A part of the letter said, "Please excuse any mistakes, as I am 70 years of age. I lost my 2 lovely boys, and then I lost my dear wife. A 3rd son is recovering from his wounds."
When you reflect on that experience of your family in World War One, how do you feel, Lynn?
I feel it's a real waste of men's lives. They just keep sending them there like they were nothing.
One last name from the cave, from a Lieutenant Harry Blunt, from Saddleworth, just north of Adelaide. Gilles Prielot found Harry's descendant, Diane Ross. who's Harry's granddaughter.
I'm his granddaughter. His son is my father.
Harry came home from the war. He was a lovely man, and Diane got to know him well.
Yes, I knew him, and he died when I was about 34.
When you got talking with him, did he ever talk much about his years in the First World War?
Never. And my dad also has no recollection of him talking about anything other than the good things, the sights they saw, the pyramids in Egypt and things like that.
So when did you find out about his experiences during the war?
Well, when my grandfather died, my father being the only son, inherited all his belongings. And there were three small diaries amongst his possessions. And I kind of felt I got to know my grandfather all over again.
So you saw him as a young man for the first time?
Absolutely. Well, he was in his early 20s when he went to war, so he wasn't as young as some of them.
What did the diaries look like, Diane?
They were little tiny black books, quite small, and the writing, you know, they all the people in those days had beautiful copper plate writing. And tiny, it was tiny. I had to use a magnifying glass for some of it to work out what was written.
And what were most of the diary entries about?
He wrote an entry in the diary every day, even when, you know, you would think you'd had such an awful day. He would still write an entry in there about what had happened that day, what time he was on signals duty, and also the things they went off and did, like had a swim, ate what they ate, and always recorded letters received from Australia and to Australia. He always, and they were all numbered, like he'd wrote letter number 15 to mother, received letter number 30 from GMS, who was my grandmother, who was his fiancée at the time.
Before the war, Harry had worked on the railways in South Australia.
He was a station master at different country railway stations. And so they were all those boys were very good with Morse code and with signals with flags.
He signed up in 1915 and he entered the ranks as a private. His early diary entries are full of excitement.
Yes, off on the ship, couldn't wait to get going, and there was a big send-off at the wharf with streamers and things being thrown backwards and forwards. Yeah, it was all very exciting. They had no idea what they were in for.
When your grandfather was leaving Australia on the boat, tell me how he tried to send a message to his fiancée.
Oh, he and a friend wrote letters to their sweethearts, and they put it in a bottle, these two fellows.
And then threw the bottle overboard in the hope that it might somehow reach the women back home. Harry already had some training in signalling, so he naturally became a signalman.
So he was never in the trenches. He was always back a kilometre or two behind the trenches, behind the front line. So I doubt he fired a shot in anger. He was in a trench somewhere. They certainly got bombed. They had to run out and lay cables, and he got a commendation from General Haig for bravery for doing that, but he was never actually in amongst all the carnage.
After the war, Harry Blunt returned to his old life as a civilian.
He arrived in Melbourne on the 17th of July 1919, and then he married my grandmother fairly soon after that, on the 2nd of October 1919.
And did he just return to his job at the railways after that?
Yes, went back to the railways. And so he then moved, they moved around. My dad remembers living in lots of different country towns in South Australia as they went from one railway station to another, and he ended up the station master or the assistant station master at Adelaide Railway Station.
One day in 1938, Harry and his wife received word that the message in the bottle, the one that he'd thrown overboard on his way to war 23 years earlier, had washed ashore.
At a place called Cape Riche. A lady called Mrs. Len Eastwood and her three-year-old son Stanley found it on the beach. And then they tracked my grandparents down and found they'd married. and were able to reunite them with the letter, which was fabulous. But it wasn't a sweetheart sort of letter. It simply said, going well on the SS Ulysses, troop ship A38, just had a bonza big dinner and feeling good after it. Concert on board tonight, think I'll be righto for it. Au revoir, Australia. We'll bring the Kaiser back with us. But at least Grandma and Grandpa were reunited with the letter in the bottle, which was great.
Shame you didn't bring the Kaiser back to Australia, though, isn't it?
Exactly.
So what led you to want to go to France and visit the battlefields yourself, Diane?
I think it was actually transcribing the diaries. It opened a whole new world for me. I mean, I'd never really thought about it. And because you've got that personal context, you know, you go to a place and you go into these little towns, you think, oh, God, my grandfather was here, you know. You hear all about the tragedy of the war and how many people were killed. But when you go there, it just makes it feel so real and so tragic, you know, just shameful, really, that could happen. And what have we learnt? I'm not sure what we've learnt.
She did go to the underground city of Nahor, but she wasn't able to find his signature among the thousands of names on the cave walls. But when she got home, she received an email, out of the blue, from Gilles Prilot, who was keen to connect Harry's name on the wall with Harry the Man. So, Diane, I'd love you to read the entry in his diary from the day he spent at the caves of Nahor.
Okay. It's Friday, the 11th of August, 1916. So, off 8 a.m, four of us went through Havanas and Flesselles. Lovely day, hung on behind a motor lorry up the steep hills. Well, we had a great time, bought up all sorts at the canteen and rode out towards Nahor and had tin sausages, sauce and bread and tin fruit for dinner under some trees. On again to Nahor, a great spin down the hill. Here we cooled off and visited the Souterrains caves. Entering the old wooden door with our guide, it was terrifically cold. We walked for an hour and went through passages and rooms all dug out by people in the times of the Normans. These caves were made as hiding places for the people to take refuge in when attacked by brigands, etc. They used to have their families' horses, etc., all hidden in this place. On the walls are hundreds of visitors' names. Of course, ours went on also. Amongst those I noticed was John Norton of Sydney, the notorious paper proprietor. Many shafts pierced through the caves coming from underneath a windmill or house. These were used to trick the enemy. After a good spin, we landed back at 4 p.m. On duty, 6 p.m. to 10 p.m. in bed.
In the end, there was no great mystery to it. In 1916, the caves had become a hugely popular sightseeing destination for Australian soldiers, looking for something to take their minds off the war on their days off. Now, you might wonder why they would want to come here ahead of a terrifying battle. Why wouldn't they want to lose themselves in singing and drinking? But once you enter the caves of Nahor, it kind of makes sense.
They find here a little peace, quiet, to forget the war, because a lot of them go to fight the day after. A lot of them died a few days after. It's very moving for me because I imagine them with cigarettes, afraid themselves. Just a moment of peace for us. Here, you don't have the shells, not a broom, broom. Here, it's quiet, very quiet. And they said, oh, it's time to go. And just before to go, they put the signature of the wall and said, I am here. I come off the end of the world. Maybe tomorrow it's the last day for me. I want to put traces of the wall.
Quand au bout de 8 jours, possible, mais c'est bien fini, on en a assez, personne ne veut plus marcher.
This second episode of Armistice was produced by Jenna Coda and me, with assistance from Sophie Townsend. Executive producer is Pam O'Brien, and the sound engineer is Russell Stapleton. Huge thanks to Caroline Campanier and Dale Starr at the Department of Veterans Affairs, and to Harriet O'Malley and the Australian Embassy in Paris, to Paul Hamm, and most of all to Gilles Prilot, archaeologist extraordinaire who has rendered such a kind service to Australia, a faraway country he's never actually set foot in.
One day, I go to Australia and I want to drink a beer on the terrace of Café of Australia.
Qu'on doit laisser sa peau, car nous sommes tous condamnés, nous sommes les sacrifiés. Adieu la vie, adieu l'amour, adieu toutes les femmes. C'est bien fini, c'est pour toujours de cette guerre infâme. C'est à Craon, sur le plateau, laisser sa peau, car nous sommes tous condamnés, nous sommes des sacrifiés.
Tomorrow, the man with a cafe in a tiny French town with a garden that's stocked full of bombs, bullets and shells from 100 years ago. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.